Calypso asked. I just said they were untold. I do know that Trophonius would fill your mind with bits of nightmarish verse that, if assembled properly, became a prophecy. Once you stumbled out of the cave, assuming you lived and weren't driven permanently insane, the priests would sit you down on the throne of memory. The verses would come spilling out of your mouth, a priest would write them down, and voila! There's your prophecy. With any luck, your mind would return to normal. Leo whistled. That is one messed up oracle. I like the singing trees better. I suppressed a shudder. Leo hadn't been with me in the Grove of Dodona. He didn't appreciate just how terrible those clashing voices were. But he had a point. There was a reason few people remembered the Cave of Trophonius. It wasn't a place that got rave write-ups in the yearly Hot Oracles to Visit Now articles. Calypso took a breadpan from me and began to rinse it. She seemed to know what she was doing, though her hands were so lovely I couldn't imagine she often did her own dishes. I would have to ask her which moisturizer she used. What if the petitioner couldn't use the throne? She asked. Leo snickered. Use the throne. Calypso glared at him. Sorry. Leo tried to look serious, which for him was always a losing battle. If the petitioner couldn't use the throne, I said, there would be no way to extract the bits of verse from his or her mind. The petitioner would be stuck with those horrors from the cave forever. Calypso rinsed the pan. Georgina, that poor child. What do you think happened to her? I didn't want to think about that. The possibilities made my skin crawl. Somehow she must have made it into the cave. She survived the oracle. She made it back here, but not in good shape. I recalled the frowny-faced, knife-wielding stick figures on her bedroom wall. My guess is that the Emperor subsequently seized control of the Throne of Memory. Without that, Georgina would never be able to recover fully. Perhaps she left again and went looking for it, and was captured. Leo muttered a curse in Spanish. I keep thinking about my little bro Harley back at camp. If somebody tried to hurt him... He shook his head. Who is this emperor, and how soon can we stomp him? I scrubbed the last of the pans. At least this was one epic quest I had successfully completed. I stared at the bubbles fizzing on my hands. I have a pretty good idea who the emperor is, I admitted. Josephine started to say his name, but Emmy is right. It's best not to speak it aloud. The new Hercules. I swallowed. In my stomach, salad and bread seemed to be holding a mud wrestling contest. He was not a nice person. In fact, if I had the right emperor, this quest could be personally awkward. I hoped I was wrong. Perhaps I could stay at the way station and direct operations while Calypso and Leo did the actual fighting. That seemed only fair since I'd had to scrub the dishes. Leo put away the dinner plates. His eyes scanned side to side as if reading invisible equations. This project Josephine is working on, he said. She's building some kind of tracking device. I didn't ask, but she must be trying to find Georgina. Of course. Calypso's voice took on a sharper edge. Can you imagine losing your child? Leo's ears reddened. Yeah. But I was thinking, if we can get back to Festus, I could run some numbers. Maybe reprogram his Archimedes sphere. Calypso threw in the towel, quite literally. It landed in the sink with a damp flop. Leo, you can't reduce everything to a program. He blinked. I'm not. You're trying to fix it, Calypso said, as if every problem is a machine. Joe and Emmy are in serious pain. Emmy told me they're thinking about abandoning the way station, giving themselves up to the Emperor if it'll save their daughter. They don't need gadgets or jokes or fixes. Try listening. Leo held out his hands. For once, he didn't seem to know what to do with them.
Look, babe.
Don't babe me, she snapped. Don't...
Apollo!
Josephine's voice boomed from the main hall. She didn't sound panicked, exactly, but definitely tense. Somewhat like the atmosphere in the kitchen. I stepped away from the happy couple. Calypso's outburst had taken me by surprise, but as I thought about it, I recalled half a dozen other spats between her and Leo as we had traveled west. I simply hadn't thought much about them because, well, the fights weren't about me. Also, compared to godly lovers' quarrels, Leo and Calypso's were nothing. I pointed over my shoulder. I think I'll just, I left the kitchen. In the middle of the main hall, Emmy and Josephine stood with their weapons at their sides. I couldn't quite read their expressions. Expectant? On edge? The way Zeus's cupbearer Ganymede always looked whenever he gave Zeus a new wine to try. Apollo? Emmy pointed over my head, where griffin nests lined the edge of the ceiling. You have a visitor. In order to see who Emmy was pointing at, I had to step forward onto the rug and turn around. In retrospect, I shouldn't have done that. As soon as I placed my foot on the rug, I thought, wait, was this rug here before? Which was followed closely by the thought, why does this rug look like a tightly woven net? Followed by, this is a net. Followed by, yikes! The net enmeshed me and rocketed me into the air. I regained the power of flight. For a microsecond, I imagined I was being recalled to Olympus, ascending in glory to sit at the right hand of my father. Well, three thrones down on Zeus's right, anyway. Then gravity took hold. I bounced like a yo-yo. One moment, I was eye level with Leo and Calypso, who were gaping at me from the kitchen entrance. The next moment, I was even with the griffin's nests, staring into the face of a goddess I knew all too well. You're probably thinking, it was Artemis. This net trap was just a little sibling prank. Surely no loving sister would let her brother suffer so much for so long. She has finally come to rescue our hero, Apollo. No, it was not Artemis. The young woman sat on the molding ledge, playfully swinging her legs. I recognized her elaborately laced sandals, her dress made from layers of mesh and forest-colored camouflage. Her braided auburn hair made a ponytail so long it wrapped around her neck like a scarf or a noose. Her fierce, dark eyes reminded me of a panther watching its prey from the shadows of the underbrush. A panther with a twisted sense of humor. A goddess, yes, but not the one I had hoped for. You, I snarled. It was difficult to sound menacing while bobbing up and down in a net. Hello, Apollo. Britomartis, the goddess of nets, smiled coyly. I hear you're human now.
This is going to be fun.
9. Of course it's a trap. With her, it always is one. Trappy McTrapface. Britomartis jumped from the ledge and landed in a kneeling position. Her skirts spread around her in a pool of netting.
She loves those dramatic entrances. She is such an anime character wannabe. The goddess rose. She pulled out her hunting knife. Apollo, if you value your anatomy, hold still. I had no time to protest that I couldn't exactly hold still while suspended in a swaying net. She slashed her knife across my groin. The net broke and spilled me to the floor, thankfully with my anatomy intact. My landing was not graceful. Fortunately, Leo and Calypso rushed to my aid. They each took an arm and helped me up. I was reassured to see that despite their recent spat, they could still unite on important matters like my welfare. Leo reached into his tool belt, perhaps searching for a weapon. Instead, he produced a tin of breath mints. I doubted that would do us much good. "Who is this lady?" he asked me. "Britomartis," I said. "The Lady of Nets." Leo looked dubious. "Does that include basketball and the internet?" "Just hunting and fishing nets," I said. "She is one of my sister's minions." "Minion?" Britomartis wrinkled her nose. "I am no minion." Behind us, Josephine coughed. Sorry, Apollo. The lady insisted on getting your attention this way." The goddess's face brightened. "Well, I had to see if he would step in my trap. And he did, as usual." "Hemethia, Josephine, give us the room, please." Our hosts glanced at each other, probably wondering which of them would have to clean up the bodies after Britomartis was through with us. Then they retreated through a doorway at the back of the hall. Calypso sized up the net goddess. "Britomartis, eh? Never heard of you. You must be minor." Britomartis smiled thinly. "Oh, but I've heard of you, Calypso. Exiled to Ogygia after the Titan War, waiting for whatever man might wash up on your shores to break your heart and leave you alone again. That must have gotten terribly old." She turned to Leo. "This is your rescuer, eh? A bit short and scruffy for a knight in shining armor." "Hey, lady." Leo shook his tin of breath mints. "I've blown up way more powerful goddesses than you before."
"And he's not my rescuer," Calypso added.
"Yeah," Leo frowned. "Wait, I kind of was, actually."
"Nor is he a knight," Calypso mused, "although he is short and scruffy."
A puff of smoke rose from Leo's collar. "Anyway," he faced Britomartis, "where do you get off ordering Joe and Emmy around like this is your house?" I grabbed his breath mints before Britomartis could transform them into nitroglycerin.
"Leo, I'm afraid this is her house."
The goddess gave me that coquettish smile I hated so much. The one that made me feel as if hot nectar were bubbling in my stomach.
"Why, Apollo, you made a correct deduction. How did you manage it?"
Whenever I was faced with Britomartis, I made myself just a bit taller than she. Alas, now I could not change my height at will. The best I could do was push up on the balls of my feet.
"Nero called this place the House of Nets," I said.
"I should have realized the way station was your idea. Whenever my sister wanted to design some elaborate contraption, something twisted and dangerous, she always turned to you." The goddess curtsied, swirling her net skirts.
"You flatter me. Now come, my friends. Let's sit and talk."
She gestured to the nearest cluster of sofas. Leo approached the furniture cautiously. For all his faults, he was not stupid. Calypso was about to sink into an armchair when Leo caught her wrist. "Hold up." From his tool belt, he pulled a folding yardstick. He extended it and poked the chair's seat cushion. A bear trap snapped shut, ripping through stuffing and fabric like an upholstery sharknado. Calypso glared at Britomartis.
Are you kidding? Oops,
Britomartis said gleefully. Leo pointed to one of the sofas, though I could see nothing amiss. There's a tripwire along the back of those cushions, too. Does that trigger a bouncing Betty? Britomartis laughed. You're good. Yes, indeed. That is a modified pressure-activated S-mine. Lady, if that went off, it would bounce 3 feet in the air, explode, and kill all of us with shrapnel.
Exactly, Britomartis said with delight. Leo Valdez, you'll do nicely.
Leo glowered at her. He pulled some wire cutters from his belt, walked over to the sofa, and deactivated the mine. I took a breath for the first time in several seconds.
I think I'll sit over here.
I pointed to the opposite sofa.
Is that safe?
Leo grunted. Yeah, looks okay. Once we were all comfortably settled in, with no one mangled or killed, Britomartis lounged across the formerly bear-trapped armchair and smiled.
Well, isn't this nice?
No, the three of us chorused. Britomartis toyed with her braid, possibly looking for tripwires she might have forgotten about.
You asked me why I sent Joe and Emmy away. I love them dearly, but I don't think they'd appreciate the quest I'm about to give you. Quest?
Calypso arched her eyebrows.
I'm pretty sure I'm an older divinity than you, Bouncing Betty. What right do you have to give me a quest?
Britomartis flashed that flirty smile.
Aren't you cute? Hun, I was around when the ancient Greeks were living in caves. I started out as a Cretan goddess.
When the rest of my pantheon died out, Artemis befriended me. I joined her hunters, and here I am, thousands of years later, still weaving my nets and setting my traps.
Yes, I grumbled. Here you are.
The goddess spread her arms. Lead weights and fishing hooks dangled from her embroidered sleeves.
Dear Apollo, you really do make a darling Lester Papadopoulos. Come here. Don't tease me,
I begged.
I'm not. Now that you're a harmless mortal, I've decided to finally give you that kiss.
I knew she was lying. I knew that her dress would entangle me and hurt me. I recognized the malicious gleam in her rust-red eyes. She had led me astray so many times over the millennia. I flirted shamelessly with all my sister's followers. But Britomartis was the only one who ever flirted back. Even though she was just as much an avowed maiden as any hunter, she delighted in tormenting me. And how many times had she pranked me by offering to set me up with other people? Gah! Artemis had never been known for her sense of humor, but her sidekick, Britomartis, more than made up for that. She was insufferable. Beautiful, but insufferable. I admit, I was tempted. Weak mortal flesh, even weaker than divine flesh. I shook my head. You're tricking me. I won't do it. She looked offended. When have I ever tricked you? Thebes! I cried. You promised to meet me in the forest for a romantic picnic. Instead, I was trampled by a giant wild boar.
That was a misunderstanding.
What about the Ingrid Bergman incident?
Oh, she really did want to meet you. How was I to know someone had dug a Burmese tiger pit outside her trailer?
And the date with Rock Hudson? Britomartis shrugged. Well, I never actually said he was waiting for you in the middle of that minefield. I just let you assume. You have to admit, though, the two of you would have made a cute couple. I whimpered and pulled my curly mortal hair. Britomartis knew me too well. I was a fool for being in a cute couple. Leo looked back and forth between us, as if he'd stumbled across a heated game of Greek fire toss. It was big in Byzantium. Don't ask. Rock Hudson, he said. In a minefield. Britomartis beamed. Apollo was so adorable, skipping through the daisies until he exploded. In case you've forgotten, I muttered, I am no longer immortal, so please, no Burmese tiger pits. I wouldn't dream of it, said the goddess. No, this quest isn't designed to kill you. It might kill you, but it's not designed to. I just want my griffins back. Calypso frowned. Your griffins? Yes, the goddess said. They are winged lion-eagle hybrids with... I know what a griffin is, Calypso said. I know Joe and Emmy breed them here, but why are they yours? I coughed. Calypso, griffins are the goddess's sacred animals. She is their mother. Britomartis rolled her eyes. Only in a figurative sense. I don't sit on their eggs and hatch them. You convinced me to do that once, I recalled, for a kiss I never got. She laughed. Yes, I'd forgotten about that. At any rate, the local emperor has captured my babies, Heloise and Abelard. In fact, he's been capturing mythical animals from all over the Midwest to use in his diabolic games. They must be freed. Leo studied the disassembled landmine pieces in his lap. The kid, Georgina? That's why you don't want Joe and Emmy here. You're putting your griffin's safety ahead of their daughters. Britomartis shrugged. Joe and Emmy's priorities have been compromised. They would not be able to hear this. But the griffins must come first. I have my reasons. Being a goddess, my needs take precedence. Calypso sniffed with disgust. You're as greedy and territorial as your babies. I'll pretend I didn't hear that, said the goddess. I promised Artemis I would try to help you three, but don't test my patience. You'd look wonderful as a northern-crested newt. A mixture of hope and sadness welled in my chest. Artemis, my loving sister, had not abandoned me after all. Zeus may have forbidden the other Olympians from helping me, but at least Artemis had sent her lieutenant, Britomartis. Of course, Britomartis' idea of help involved testing us with landmines and bear traps. But at this point, I would take what I could get. And if we find these griffins, I asked. Then I'll tell you how to infiltrate the Emperor's lair, Britomartis promised. Being the goddess of traps, I know all about secret entrances. I stared at her. How is that a fair trade? Because, you adorable Lester, you need to infiltrate the palace to rescue Georgina and the other prisoners. Without them, the way station is doomed. And so are your chances of stopping the triumvirate. Also, the palace is where you'll find the Throne of Memory. If you can't retrieve that, your trip to the Cave of Trophonius will kill you. You'll never save the other oracles. You'll never get back to Mount Olympus. I turned to Leo. I'm new to this heroic quest business. Shouldn't there be a reward at the end? Not just more deadly quests? Nope, Leo said. This is pretty standard. Oh, the injustice! A minor goddess forcing me, one of the 12 Olympians, to retrieve animals for her.
I silently vowed that if I ever regained my godhood, I would never again send a poor mortal on a quest. Unless it was really important. And unless I was sure the mortal could handle it. And unless I was pressed for time. Or I just really didn't feel like doing it myself. I would be much kinder and more generous than this net goddess was being to me. What would you have us do? I asked Britomartis. Wouldn't these griffins be held at the Emperor's palace? Couldn't we do some one-stop shopping? Oh, no, Britomartis said. The really important animals, the rare and valuable ones, the Emperor keeps those in a special facility with the proper resources to care for them. The Indianapolis Zoo. I shuddered. I find zoos to be depressing places, full of sad caged animals, screaming children, and bad food. The griffins will be well guarded, I guessed. Absolutely. Britomartis sounded a bit too excited about the prospect. So please try to release the griffins before you get injured or killed. Also, you must hurry. Here comes a time limit. Leo looked at me knowingly. There's always a time limit. In 3 days, Britomartis continued, the Emperor plans to use all the animals and prisoners in one massive celebration. A naming ceremony, I recalled. Nanette, the Blemii who almost killed us, she mentioned something about that. Indeed, Britomartis grimaced. This Emperor, he loves naming things after himself. At the ceremony, he plans to rechristen Indianapolis. That in itself did not strike me as a tragedy. Indianapolis was a rather difficult name to love. However, if this emperor was who I thought he was, his idea of a celebration involved slaughtering people and animals by the thousands. He really was not the sort of person you wanted organizing your child's birthday party. The Blemii mentioned something else, I said. The emperor wanted to sacrifice 2 special prisoners, me and the girl. Calypso clasped her hands like the jaws of the bear trap. Georgina. Exactly. Britomartis again sounded a bit too cheerful. The girl is safe enough for now. Imprisoned and insane, yes, but alive. You concentrate on freeing my griffins. Go to the zoo at first light. The Emperor's guards will be ending their night shift then. They'll be tired and inattentive. I gazed at the landmine pieces in Leo's hands. Death by explosion was starting to sound like a kinder fate than Britomartis's quest. At least I won't be alone, I muttered. Actually, said the goddess, Leo Valdez must remain here. Leo flinched. Say what? You've proven yourself skilled with traps, the goddess explained. Emmy and Josephine need your help. The way station has defied discovery by the Emperor so far, but that won't last much longer. He can't tolerate any opposition. He will find this sanctuary, and he means to destroy it. You, Leo Valdez, can help shore up the defenses. But... Cheer up, Britomartis faced Calypso. You can go with Apollo, my dear. 2 former immortals on a quest for me. Yes, I like that idea a lot. Calypso paled. But no, I don't. She can't, I added. The sorceress nodded emphatically. We don't get along, so... It's settled then. The goddess rose from her chair. I'll meet you back here when you have my griffins. Don't fail me, mortals. She clapped her hands with glee. Ah, I've always wanted to say that. She twirled and disappeared in a flash like a fishing lure, leaving nothing behind but a few treble hooks snagged in the carpet. 10.
scrubbing toilets now. At least there's a great reward. Leftover tofu. After bear traps and pressure-activated explosives, I didn't think the afternoon could get any worse. Of course it did. Once we told Emmy and Josephine what had happened with Britta Martis, our hosts sank into despair. They didn't seem reassured that the Griffin quest might lead to Georgina's rescue, or that their little girl would remain alive until the spectacular killfest the Emperor had planned in 3 days. Emmy and Joe were so resentful, not just of Britta Martis, but also of us, that they assigned us more chores. Oh, sure, they claimed that all guests had to help out. The way station was a communal living space, not a hotel, blah, blah, blah. I knew better. There was no way scrubbing toilets in the way station's 26 known bathrooms was anything but a punishment. At least I didn't have to change the hay in the Griffin's lofts. By the time Leo was done with that, he looked like the victim of mugging by Scarecrow. As for Calypso, she got to plant mung beans all afternoon with Emmy. I ask you, how is that fair? By dinner time, I was starving. I hoped for another fresh meal, preferably one prepared for me, but Josephine waved listlessly toward the kitchen. I think there's some leftover tofu enchiladas in the fridge. Agamethus will show you to your rooms. She and Emmy left us to fend for ourselves. The glowing orange ghost escorted Calypso to her room first. Agamethus let it be known via the magic eight ball and lots of gesticulation that girls and boys always slept in entirely different wings. I found this ridiculous, but like so many things about my sister and her hunters, it was beyond logic. Calypso didn't complain. Before leaving, she turned to us hesitantly and said, "See you in the morning," as if this was a huge concession, as if by talking to Leo and me at all, she was going above and beyond the courtesy we deserved. Honestly, I didn't see how anyone could act so haughty after an afternoon planting legumes. A few minutes later, armed with leftovers from the fridge, Leo and I followed Agamethus to our guest room. That's right, we had to share, which I took as another sign of our host's displeasure. Before leaving us, Agamethus tossed me his magic eight ball. I frowned. "I didn't ask you a question." He pointed emphatically at the magic orb. I turned it over and read, "Apollo must bring her home." I wished the ghost had a face so I might interpret it. "You already told me that." I tossed the ball back to him, hoping for further explanation. Agamethus hovered expectantly, as if waiting for me to realize something. Then, shoulders slumped, he turned and floated away. I was in no mood for reheated tofu enchiladas. I gave mine to Leo, who sat cross-legged on his bed and inhaled his food. He still wore Georgina's coveralls, with a light frosting of hay. He seemed to have decided that being able to fit in a 7-year-old girl's work clothes was a mark of honor. I lay back on my bed. I stared at the arched brickwork on the ceiling, wondering if and when it would collapse on my head. I missed my cot at Camp Half-Blood. "This place ain't so bad," Leo said. "When I was between foster homes, I slept under the Main Street Bridge in Houston for like a month." I glanced over. He did look quite comfortable in his nest of hay and blankets. "You will change clothes before turning in?" I asked. He shrugged. "I'll shower in the morning. If I get itchy in the middle of the night, I'll just burst into flames." I'm not in the mood for joking. Not after Britta Martis. "Who's joking? Don't worry, I'm sure Joe has this place rigged with fire suppression equipment." The thought of waking up burning and covered in extinguisher foam did not appeal to me, but it would be about par for the course. Leo tapped his fork against his plate. These tofu enchiladas are sabrosas. Gotta get the recipe from Josephine. My homegirl Piper would love them.
How can you be so calm? I demanded. I am going on a dangerous quest tomorrow with your girlfriend.
Normally, telling a mortal man that I was going somewhere with his girlfriend would have been enough to break his heart. Leo concentrated on his tofu. You guys will do fine.
But Calypso has no powers. How will she help me?
It ain't about powers, Esse. You watch. Calypso will still save your sorry butt tomorrow. I didn't like that idea. I didn't want my sorry butt dependent on a former sorceress who had failed at street fighting and improvisational comedy, especially given her recent mood.
And if she's still angry in the morning? I asked. What's going on between you two?
Leo's fork hovered above his last enchilada.
It's just 6 months we were traveling, trying to get to New York. Constant danger, never staying in the same place longer than a night. Then another month and a half getting to Indianapolis.
I considered that. I tried to imagine suffering through 4 times as many trials as I'd already experienced.
I suppose that would put pressure on a new relationship.
Leo nodded glumly. Calypso lived on her island for thousands of years, man. She's all about gardening, weaving tapestries, making her surroundings beautiful. You can't do any of that when you don't have a home. Then there's the fact that I took her away.
You rescued her, I said. The gods were in no hurry to free her from her prison. She might have been on that island for 1,000 more years.
Leo chewed his last bite. He swallowed as if the tofu had turned to clay,
which, in my opinion, would not have been a dramatic change.
Sometimes she's happy about it, he said. Other times, without her powers, without her immortality. It's like, he shook his head. I was going to compare our relationship to a machine. She would hate that.
I don't mind machines. He set his plate on the nightstand.
An engine is only built to handle so much stress, you know? Run it too fast for too long, it starts to overheat.
This I understood. Even my Sun Chariot got a bit touchy when I drove it all day in Maserati form.
You need time for maintenance. You haven't had a chance to find out who you are as a couple without all the danger and constant movement.
Leo smiled, though his eyes were devoid of their usual impish gleam.
Yeah, except danger and constant movement, that's pretty much my life. I don't know how to fix that, if it's even fixable.
He picked a few pieces of straw off his borrowed coveralls.
Enough of that. Better sleep while you can, Sonny. I'm gonna crash.
Don't call me Sonny, I complained.
But it was too late. When Leo shuts down, he does so with the efficiency of a diesel generator. He flopped down sideways and immediately began to snore.
I was not so lucky. I lay in bed for a long while, counting golden carnivorous sheep in my mind, until at last I drifted into uneasy sleep.
11. 4 beheaded dudes. Are too much for one nightmare.
Why me? Sob, sob, sob.
Naturally, I had terrible dreams. I found myself standing at the foot of a mighty fortress on a moonless night. Before me, rough-hewn walls soared hundreds of feet upward, flecks of feldspar glittering like stars. At first, I heard nothing but the whistling cries of owls in the woods behind me, a sound that always reminded me of nighttime in ancient Greece. Then, at the base of the stronghold, stone ground against stone. A small hatch appeared where none had been before. A young man crawled out, lugging a heavy sack behind him. Come on, he hissed to someone still in the tunnel. The man struggled to his feet, the contents of his sack clinking and clanking. Either he was taking out the recycling, unlikely, or he had just stolen a great deal of treasure. He turned in my direction, and a jolt of recognition made me want to scream like an owl. It was Trophonius, my son. You know that feeling when you suspect you might have fathered someone thousands of years ago, but you're not really sure? Then you see that child as a grown man, and looking into his eyes, you know beyond a doubt that he is yours. Yes, I'm sure many of you can relate. I didn't recall who his mother was. The wife of King Erginus, perhaps? She had been quite a beauty. Trophonius's lustrous dark hair reminded me of hers. But his muscular physique and handsome face, that strong chin, that perfect nose, those rosy lips. Yes, Trophonius clearly got his knockout good looks from me. His eyes gleamed with confidence, as if to say, "That's right. I just crawled out of a tunnel, and I still look gorgeous." From the hatch, the head of another young man emerged. He must have had broader shoulders because he was having trouble squeezing through. Trophonius laughed under his breath. "I told you not to eat so much, brother." Despite his struggle, the other man looked up and grinned. He didn't resemble Trophonius at all. His hair was blonde and curly, his face as guileless, goofy, and ugly as a friendly donkey's. I realized this was Agamethus, Trophonius's half-brother. He was no son of mine. The poor boy had the misfortune of being the actual offspring of King Erginus and his wife. "I can't believe it worked," said Agamethus, wriggling his left arm free. "Of course it worked," said Trophonius. "We're famous architects. We built the temple at Delphi. Why wouldn't King Hyrieus trust us to build his treasury? Complete with a secret thieves' tunnel." "Well, he'll never know about that," Trophonius said. "The paranoid old fool will assume his servant stole all his treasure. Now hurry up, wide load." Agamethus was too busy laughing to free himself. He stretched out his arm. "Help me!" Trophonius rolled his eyes. He slung his sack of treasure to the ground and thereby sprang the trap. I knew what would happen next. I remember the tale now that I saw it unfolding, but it was still hard to watch. King Hyrieus was paranoid, all right. Days before, he had scoured the treasury for any possible weaknesses. Upon finding the tunnel, he said nothing to his servants, his building crew, or his architects. He didn't move his treasure. He simply laid a deadly trap and waited to find out exactly who planned to rob him. Trophonius set the bag of gold right on the tripwire, which only became active once the thief had exited the tunnel. The king intended to catch his betrayers red-handed. In the nearest tree, a mechanical bow fired a screaming flare skyward, cutting an arc of red flame across the dark. Inside the tunnel, a support beam snapped, crushing Agamethus's chest under a shower of stone. Agamethus gasped, his free arm flailing. His eyes bulged as he coughed blood. Trophonius cried in horror. He ran to his brother's side and tried to pull him free, but this only made Agamethus scream. "Leave me," said Agamethus. "I won't." Tears streaked Trophonius's face. "This is my fault. This was my idea. I'll get help. I'll tell the guards. They'll only kill you too," Agamethus croaked. "Go while you can. And brother, the king knows my face," he gasped, his breath gurgling. when he finds my body. Don't talk that way. He'll know you were with me, Agamethus continued, his eyes now clear and calm with the certainty of death. He'll track you down. He'll declare war on our father. Make sure my body can't be identified.
Agamethus clawed weakly at the knife hanging from his brother's belt. Trophonius wailed. He understood what his brother was asking. He heard the guards shouting in the distance. They would be here soon. He raised his voice to the heavens.
Take me instead. Save him, father, please.
Trophonius's father, Apollo, chose to ignore his prayer. I gave you fame, Apollo was thinking. I let you design my temple at Delphi. Then you used your reputation and talents to become a thief. You brought this upon yourself. In despair, Trophonius drew his knife. He kissed his brother's forehead one last time, then laid the blade across Agamethus's neck. My dream changed. I stood in a long subterranean chamber like an alternate image of the way station's main hall. Overhead, a curved ceiling glittered with white subway tiles. Along either side of the room, where the rail pits would have been in a train depot, open canals of water flowed. Rows of television monitors lined the walls, flashing video clips of a bearded man with curly brown hair, perfect teeth, and brilliant blue eyes. The videos reminded me of Times Square ads for a late-night talk show host. The man mugged for the camera, laughing, kissing the screen, pretending to be off balance. In each shot, he wore a different outfit. An Italian business suit, a race car driver's uniform, hunting fatigues, each cut from the skin of a lion. A title bounced around the screen in garish colors. The New Hercules. Yes, that's what he liked to call himself back in Roman times. He had that hero's shockingly good physique, but he wasn't the actual Hercules. I should know. I dealt with Hercules on many occasions. This emperor was more like someone's idea of Hercules, an airbrushed, overly muscular caricature. In the middle of the hall, flanked by bodyguards and attendants, was the man himself, lounging on a white granite throne. Not many emperors can look imperial wearing only lion-skin swim trunks, but Commodus managed. One of his legs was thrown casually over the throne's armrest. His golden abs formed such a six-pack, I imagined I could see the pop-top tabs. With an immensely bored expression, using only two fingers, he twirled a six-foot-long poleaxe that came very close to threatening his nearest advisor's anatomy. I wanted to whimper. Not just because I still found Commodus attractive after so many centuries, not just because we had a, complicated history, but also because he reminded me what I used to be like. Oh, to be able to look in the mirror and see perfection again. Not a pudgy, awkward boy with a bad complexion. I forced myself to focus on the other people in the room. Kneeling before the emperor were two people I'd seen in my vision of Nero's penthouse. Marcus, the blinged-out jackal boy, and Vortigern, the barbarian. Marcus was trying to explain something to the emperor. He waved his hands desperately.
We tried! Sire, listen!
The emperor did not seem inclined to listen. His uninterested gaze drifted across the throne room to various amusements. A rack of torture tools, a row of arcade games, a set of weights, and a freestanding target board plastered with... Oh dear. The face of Lester Papadopoulos, bristling with embedded throwing knives. In the shadows at the back of the room, strange animals moved restlessly in cages. I saw no griffins, But there were other fabled beasts I hadn't seen in centuries. Half a dozen winged Arabian serpents fluttered in an oversized canary cage. Inside a golden pen, a pair of bull-like creatures with huge horns snuffled at a feeding trough. European Yales, perhaps? Goodness, those had been rare even back in ancient times. Marcus kept yammering excuses until, on the Emperor's left, a portly man in a crimson business suit snapped.
Enough!
The advisor made a wide arc around the Emperor's spinning poleaxe. His face was so red and sweaty that, as a god of medicine, I wanted to warn him he was dangerously close to congestive heart failure. He advanced on the two supplicants.
You are telling us, he snarled, that you lost her? Two strong, capable servants of the triumvirate lost a little girl. How could that happen?
Marcus cupped his hands.
Lord Cleander, I don't know. We stopped at a convenience store outside of Dayton. She went to the restroom and she disappeared.
Marcus glanced at his companion for support. Vortigern grunted. Cleander, the red-suited advisor, scowled.
Was there any sort of plant near this restroom?
Marcus blinked.
Plant? Yes, you fool. The growing kind. Well, there was a clump of dandelions growing from a crack in the pavement by the door, but... What? Yelled Cleander. You let a daughter of Demeter near a plant?
A daughter of Demeter? My heart felt like it had been launched upward in one of Britomartis's nets. At first, I had wondered if these men were talking about Georgina. But they meant Meg McCaffrey. She had given her escorts the slip. Marcus gaped like a fish.
Sir, it was just a weed. Which is all she needed to teleport away, screamed Cleander. You should have realized how powerful she's becoming. Gods only know where she is now.
Actually, said the Emperor, sending a flash freeze through the room,
I'm a god, and I have no idea.
He stopped twirling his poleaxe. He scanned the throne room until his gaze fixed on a Blemyai servant arranging cakes and canapes on a tea cart. She was not in disguise. Her chest face was in full view. Though below her belly chin, she wore a maid's black skirt with a white lace apron. The Emperor took aim. He casually chucked his poleaxe across the room, the blade burying itself between the maid's eyes. She staggered, managed to say, Good shot, my lord! Then crumbled to dust. The advisors and bodyguards clapped politely. Commodus waved away their praise.
I'm bored with these two.
He gestured at Marcus and Vortigern.
They failed, yes?
Cleander bowed.
Yes, my lord. Thanks to them, the daughter of Demeter is on the loose. If she reaches Indianapolis, she could cause us no end of trouble.
The Emperor smiled.
Ah, but Cleander, you failed too, did you not?
The red-suited man gulped.
Sire, I assure you.
It was your idea to allow Nero to send these idiots. You thought they'd be helpful in capturing Apollo? Now the girl has betrayed us. And Apollo is somewhere in my city, and you haven't apprehended him yet.
Sire, the meddlesome women of the way station!
That's right, the Emperor said. You haven't found them yet either. And don't get me started on all your failures concerning the naming ceremony.
But sire, we will have thousands of animals for you to slaughter, hundreds of captives...
Boring, I told you I want something creative. Are you my Praetorian prefect or not, Cleander? Yes, sire. And so you're responsible for any failures.
But...
And you're boring me, Commodus added, which is punishable by death. He glanced to either side of the throne.
Who's next in the chain of command? Speak up.
A young man stepped forward. Not a Germanus bodyguard, but definitely a fighter. His hand rested easily on the pommel of his sword. His face was a patchwork of scars. His clothes were casual, just jeans, a red and white t-shirt that read Cornhuskers, and a red bandana tied across his curly dark hair. But he held himself with the easy confidence of a practiced killer.
I am next, sire.
Commodus inclined his head.
Do it then.
Cleander shrieked.
No!
The Cornhusker moved with blinding speed. His sword flashed. In three fluid slices, three people fell dead, their heads severed from their bodies. On the bright side, Cleander no longer had to worry about congestive heart failure. Neither did Marcus nor Vortigern. The Emperor clapped with delight.
Oh, nice! That was very entertaining, Latirces.
Thank you, sire. The Cornhusker flicked the blood from his blade.
You are almost as skilled with the sword as I am, the Emperor said. Have I ever told you how I decapitated a rhinoceros?
Yes, my lord. Most impressive. Latirces' voice was as bland as oatmeal. Your permission to clear away these bodies?
Of course, the Emperor said.
Now, you're Midas's boy, aren't you? Latirces' face seemed to develop a few new scars when he scowled.
Yes, sire.
But you can't do the golden touch thing.
No, sire.
Pity.
You do kill people well, though. That's good.
Your first orders, find Meg McCaffrey. And Apollo. Bring them to me, alive if possible, and...
There was something else.
The naming ceremony, sire?
Yes! The Emperor grinned. Yes, yes. I have some wonderful ideas to spice up the games. But since Apollo and the girl are running around loose, we should move forward our plan for the griffins. Go to the zoo right away. Bring the animals here for safekeeping. Manage all that for me, and I won't kill you. Fair?
Latirces' neck muscles tensed. Of course, sire. As the new Praetorian prefect barked orders to the guards, telling them to drag away the decapitated bodies, someone spoke my name. Apollo, wake up. My eyes fluttered open. Calypso stood over me. The room was dark. Nearby, Leo was still snoring away in his bed. It's almost first light, said the sorceress. We need to get going. I tried to blink away the remnants of my dreams. Agamethus's magic eight ball seemed to float to the surface of my mind. Apollo must bring her home. I wondered if the ghost had meant Georgina, or another girl whom I very much wanted to find. Calypso shook my shoulder. Come on, you wake up very slowly for a sun god.
What? Where?
The zoo, she said. Unless you want to wait around here for morning chores. 12. I sing of taters. Chili, sweet potato, blue. Why? Ask my arrow. Calypso knew how to motivate me.
The thought of scrubbing toilets again was more terrifying than my dreams. We walked the dark streets in the cold early morning, keeping an eye out for polite mobs of killer blemmii, but no one bothered us. Along the way, I explained my nightmares to Calypso. I spelled out the name, C-O-M-M-O-D-U-S, in case saying it aloud might attract the God Emperor's attention. Calypso had never heard of him. Of course, she'd been stuck on her island for the last few millennia. I doubted she would recognize the names of many people who hadn't washed up on her shores. She barely knew who Hercules was. I found that refreshing. Hercules was such an attention hog. "You know this emperor personally?" she asked. I convinced myself I wasn't blushing. The wind was just stinging my face. "We met when he was younger. We had a surprising amount in common. Once he became emperor," I sighed. "You know how it is. He got too much power and fame at a tender age. It messed with his head. Like Justin, Brittany, Lindsay, Amanda, Amadeus. I don't know any of those people. We need to spend more time on your pop culture lessons." "No, please." Calypso struggled with the zipper of her coat. Today she was wearing an assortment of borrowed clothing she must have picked out in total darkness. A battered silver parka, probably from Emmy's Hunters of Artemis days. A blue Indy 500 t-shirt. An ankle-length brown skirt over black leggings. And bright purple and green workout shoes. Meg McCaffrey would have approved of her fashion sense. "What about the sword-wielding cornhusker?" Calypso asked. "Laterces, son of King Midas. I don't know much about him or why he is serving the Emperor. We can only hope to get in and out of the zoo before he shows up. I don't relish the idea of meeting him in combat." Calypso flexed her fingers, perhaps remembering what happened the last time she punched someone. "At least your friend Meg escaped her escorts," she noted. "That's good news." "Perhaps." I wanted to believe Meg was rebelling against Nero, that she had finally seen the truth about her monstrous stepfather and would now rush to my side, ready to aid me in my quests and stop giving me vexing orders. Unfortunately, I knew firsthand how hard it was to extricate oneself from an unhealthy relationship. Nero's hooks were buried deep in the girl's psyche. The idea of Meg on the run without a destination, terrified, pursued by the minions of two different emperors, that did not reassure me. I hoped she at least had her friend Peaches, the grain spirit, to rely on. But I had seen no sign of him in my visions. "And Trophonius?" asked Calypso. "Do you often forget when someone is your child?" "You wouldn't understand. We're looking for a dangerous oracle that drives people insane. The spirit of this oracle happens to be your son, who just might hold a grudge against you because you didn't answer his prayers, thus forcing him to cut off his own brother's head. Those facts would have been good to know. I've had a lot on my mind. It's a very small mortal mind. At least we agree on the size of your brain." "Oh, stick a brick in it," I muttered. "I was hoping for advice on how to proceed. You're useless." "My advice is to stop being such a glutose." The word meant buttocks, except that in ancient Greek, it had a much ruder connotation. I tried to think of a withering reply, but the ancient Greek phrase for, "I know you are, but what am I," eluded me. Calypso ruffled the fletching in my quiver. "If you want advice, why not ask your arrow? Perhaps he knows how to rescue griffins." "Huh." I did not like Calypso's advice for seeking advice. I didn't see what a Shakespearean talking arrow could contribute to our present quest. Then again, I had nothing to lose except my temper. If the arrow annoyed me too much, I could always fire him into some monster's glutose. I pulled out the arrow of Dodona. Immediately, his sonorous voice spoke in my mind, the shaft resonating with each word.
Lo, it said, the mortal doth finally show sense.
I've missed you too, I said. It's talking? Calypso asked. Unfortunately, yes. Oh, arrow of Dodona, I have a question for you.
Hittest me with thy best shot.
I explained about my visions. I'm sure I looked ridiculous, talking to an arrow as we strolled along West Maryland Street. Outside the Indiana Convention Center, I tripped and nearly impaled myself through the eye. But Calypso didn't even bother to laugh. During our travels together, she'd seen me humiliate myself in much more spectacular ways. Talking proved a slower way of bringing a projectile up to speed than by simply launching it from a bow. But at last I succeeded.
Fie!
The arrow shuddered in my hand.
Thou hast given me not a question, but a story.
I wondered if it was testing me, gauging just how far it could push me before I snapped it in two. I might have done so long ago, except I feared I would then have two fragments of a talking arrow, which would give me bad advice in harmony. Very well, I said. How can we find the Griffins? Where is Meg McCaffrey? How can we defeat the local emperor, free his prisoners, and take back control of the Oracle of Trophonius?
Now hast thou asked too many questions, the arrow intoned. My wisdom doth not spew forth answers as if 'twere Google.
Yes, the arrow was definitely tempting me to snap it. Let's start simply then, I said. How do we free the Griffins?
Goest thou to the zoo?
We're already doing that.
Findest thou the Griffin's enclosure?
Yes, but where? And don't tell me at the zoo. Where exactly in the Indianapolis Zoo are the Griffins being kept?
Seekest thou the choo-choo?
The choo-choo.
Is there an echo in here?
Fine. We look for a choo... a train. Once we locate the Griffins, how do we free them?
Lo, thou shalt gain the beast's trust with tater tots.
Tater tots. I waited for clarification, or even just another snarky comment. The arrow remained silent. With a snort of disgust, I returned it to my quiver. You know, Calypso said, hearing only one side of that conversation was very confusing. 'Twas not much better hearing both sides, I assured her. Something about a train and children made of potatoes. Tater tots are food. Leo,